This is Hassling the Paranormal. I'm your host, Jason Hassler. I'm the director of Big River Paranormal, the Oregon team for the Atlantic Paranormal Society. I've been obsessed with the paranormal since having unexplained experiences as a child. These experiences left me with more questions than answers. Join me as we explore all things paranormal with some of the top specialists and experts in the paranormal community.
Hey, this is Ricky Rocket from Poison, and you're listening to Hassling the Paranormal on KXRW 99.9 FM.
Welcome to Hassling the Paranormal. I'm your host, Jason Hassler. Today's guest is paranormal researcher Ben Robison. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
It's good.
A little warm in here, but otherwise, we're good.
Yeah.
So what led to your interest in the paranormal?
It was literally kind of a familial thing. My family's been very, open to the concept of the supernatural into things. As a result, I grew up, doing things like going through old abandoned buildings and cemeteries and such. Obviously, I had some, events that took place throughout my life, and those were, big pieces to kind of the whole genesis of me being involved in paranormal research. So
like most of us, you were sneaking into places you weren't supposed to be.
Yeah. And don't do that.
Don't do that now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what areas of the paranormal have you most interested in?
I would probably say if I were to rank everything, it'd be first, supernatural phenomena, anomalous phenomena. Yeah. Cryptozoology and then ufology.
Okay.
Yeah, those would be probably the three that I personally delve into. But, obviously there's a regular occurrence of supernatural stuff going on in our field of research. So that keeps me pretty busy.
How did you get started with paranormal research?
Well, I was like anyone else. I grew up watching all the gaudy, goofy British, ghost shows, and I found them fascinating, but they just weren't enough. And then, things like In Search Of came out, and I was deeply immersed into it, and I'm still am to this day. It's a worthy show for me to rewatch even in 2026. But it was shows like that that really, kind of got me intrigued into it. But it wasn't until Ghost Hunters first came out in the very beginning.
Yeah.
I really liked it because it was probably the more serious and structured attempt at, paranormal research I had seen. So I found myself inspired by it and, took that and kind of spent a good year or so kind of developing process, procedure, and documentation before I even tried to locate, a place that, was supposedly haunted, so that way I could, do some investigating work.
Did you start out by yourself or did you have people with you?
I had a co-founder for my first paranormal group, which was called Paranormal and Occult Research Team. John was my co-founder, and he lived on the east side of Washington. So, there was a bit of a challenge logistically there. Yeah. But, we had some investigations, and, we brought on some people that I knew that were interested in this kind of stuff.
Okay.
So I was able to work with them in the beginning.
And do you have a team now?
No. And let me kind of clarify on that. So when I was running port, everybody knows there's drama in the field.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. So, I found that drama. It found me. And so I'll leave it at the Rogue Five that betrayed me. So I, tried to push past that. And I found that, a lot of people have a real interest in this, but when it comes down to the actual nitty gritty, the heavy lifting, they're not that, same person cut from the same cloth as myself. And so I had battles. So I decided at one point to step down and, you know, give the team the organization. And then I actually founded Autonomous Studies of the Enigmatic and Paranormal, which is ASEP. And that one is literally what it means, autonomous. It was always just me. What was the beauty of it was I could reach out to folks like yourself and whatnot and say, hey, come in on this case that I've taken on, you know, to, consult and, you know, bring your expertise or your knowledge in, and we'll work together on it. And so that's how ASEP has been. But in the last year or so, I started also Washington Paranormal. That the intention with that one is going to be more public facing. It's an easier name, first off, to pronounce. And so, you know, that it will be a team. It's just right now there's a lot of personal, you know, struggles and challenges going on in the background. So I'm waiting to do that, part. So.
All right. And what's your goal with Washington Paranormal?
Really, I want it to be where most clients reach out to, the one that we will mostly advertise, out there taking on cases and such. Again, it'll be, a team based organization that works under ASAP. And, it'll just give us that opportunity to have a very palatable image and name and, something that people can easily, recollect.
And is your goal there to find evidence of paranormal, or is your goal to help people with their struggles with their paranormal issues, or what exactly will you be doing with that?
I like to kind of, prioritize it. For me, it's first and foremost is helping the client.
Yeah.
Whether it's them trying to understand the weird things that are taking place, or if they're frightened because something seems, darker. I want to be able to try to discern what's going on and give them some opportunity to find out what they've been experiencing, whether it's explainable or we need to bring in somebody else that specializes in a specific area that, that might be where they need that help mostly.
Okay. So one of the things I want to talk to you about is your experience with Sasquatch.
Yeah.
So you had a personal experience?
Yeah. I have had two, I guess.
Okay.
When I was a little kid, we were out in the Columbia River Gorge out by Beacon Rock. Beacon Rock. There's a campground. I think it's like Beaver Creek or something like that campground out there. And we were out there, I think, with some friends of the family, and we were all camping. And apparently something happened with regard to what they believe was a Sasquatch. There was a smell. There was, they sighted, this bipedal creature or whatever. And apparently even us kids saw it. But unfortunately, that was so long ago. I don't have a recollection of it. And so my mother, she's the one that's helped me understand that that was also the first one. But then if you fast forward, a good decade at least, I was living up in the Olympic Peninsula of Washington State, and this is the 80s, and at that time they had what they called a hardship license, or a permit, really, is what it was. And that allowed you to, if you could pass a very simple driving test and understand just the basic rules of, turn signaling, headlights, braking, all that kind of stuff, that you could, at that point in time, operate a vehicle in rural areas. Where I lived was an area called Matlock, Washington, which is kind of north of Shelton. And it was a big logging community. And so the person I was living with at that time, he actually worked out in the forest picking things like ferns, salial, pine cones, mushrooms. And most of it was for like florists. There were cases where he did stuff where, like, I remember, I think it was the Empire Strikes Back movie with the four scenes. Okay. A lot of the stuff that we were picking went to that at that time. So, it got to a point where, you know, it made more sense for him to be dropped off out into the woods and do his job. And then at a certain time I come out there and pick him up. So I was kind of doing that normal routine. And this was a, you know, latter part of the year where weather was changing. And on the left side of the highway that I was driving down, mind you, I'm in this old, rusty, beat-up Dodge pickup with, like, a wood flatbed, right?
How old were you at the time?
I think I was about 12. Yeah, oh, wow. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm driving this pickup down the road to go pick him up. Or bring him lunch, that I cannot recall for sure, because the real thing that happened was the thing that really stuck with me. And I'm driving down this road, and on the left side of the road is like clear-cut forest that they had already logged. And then the highway itself, the two-lane highway, sat higher than the actual natural ground of the forest around it, right? And on the right-hand side of that highway was untouched forest that hadn't been logged yet. And so at this particular time, it started snowing, and to the point so where it was sticking and actually accumulating on the blacktop.
Yeah.
So as I'm driving down the road, I see, mind you, again, you know, I'm a 12-year-old kid, so I'm guesstimating that I thought it was about a mile down in front of me. I saw a very tall-looking, dark-colored bipedal thing come out of the left side of the clear cut up onto the highway and across it. And we're talking like the gait that this thing had, it didn't look like it was running, but man, it covered ground like nobody's business. And so I would say it probably took maybe one or two steps across the highway and then went into the right side of the forest where it was, you know, unlogged. So I was like, what did I just see? Did I? And immediately and admittedly, I thought it was a Bigfoot. So I wanted to stop where I thought it was that it crossed and see if I could see any tracks. So I stopped where I thought it had crossed. I didn't see anything, and I didn't have much time because there was a vehicle coming down the highway behind me. So I had to jump back in and continue my little mission to go, you know, pick up this guy or bring him lunch or whatever. So that was what I saw probably in like 88 or so.
That's pretty brave to stop and look for that, you know, by yourself at 12. I mean, you're either brave or stupid. I don't
know. Well, I would probably say it's more on the stupid end, naive end, because I'm 12, you know, I mean, I was just like, whoa. So I just wanted to see if I could find any extra proof of what I thought it would was.
Did you tell the guy that what you saw or?
Yeah. Yeah. And he was a big believer.
Yeah.
And he was, I literally pretty much heard him say, yeah, I mean, that's not surprising.
Yeah. So in your opinion, what is Sasquatch? Do you believe it's more of a paranormal creature, or are you in the belief Sasquatch is like an undiscovered ape-like creature?
Jury's out, I guess, on that. I have, you know, the rest of my life to try to research that unless somebody, you know, figures that out, obviously, before me. But, there, I think it's plausible that there is a, you know, preternatural type essence to these beings, these creatures. But I think for the most part, they are creatures that have been very elusive and are very educated, smart, you know, beings. So I think they just know how to avoid us. They know how to, you know, keep themselves kind of still enigmatic for the most part.
Yeah, which is pretty smart. Stay away from humans.
Yes, absolutely.
What do you think the best example of evidence for the existence of Sasquatch is right now?
Well, I still think the Patterson-Gimlin film is probably one of the best. You know, and I know people have their feelings and their debates and such. But I really think that that's one of the most authentic pieces of genuine footage of a female Sasquatch in California, Northern California. I also liked Paul Freeman's footage of seeing what he thought was a small family of them in the Blue Mountains.
Okay.
East side of the state. So outside of that, we're plagued with, you know, the stuff of AI everywhere nowadays. So, you know, anybody that opens up any kind of social media is just going to get it dumped on them. And yeah, it looks convincing and real, but, you know, unfortunately, AI is, you know, doing its thing and fooling people.
It's making things really tough for us in the paranormal investigation field, for sure. It's to the point where I've gotten to where if I wasn't there when the video was taken, I'm not commenting on it. Unless it's something absolutely obvious, I can say this is BS, you know, like.
Well, and I think another thing that a lot of researchers or people out there, enthusiasts, whatever, are doing with this supposed evidence, they really need to be including things like metadata, video and photography, especially because it tells us if it's been altered. It tells us, you know, what it was captured on, you know, and a bunch of different info. Yeah, maybe even, it could even have the longitude and latitude, you know, GPS coordinates, so.
Yeah, that's an interesting look at that. I mean, because most of the time when you see that online, people don't add that information. They just say, hey, I was taking this video. And
I get the coordinates, you know, because again, you don't want to swarm an area with a bunch of people that think, you know, they're going to get it. A
bunch of rednecks out there hunting for Bigfoot.
Yeah. Right, right. You know, but at the same time, I think it's kind of, we're at that point now because unfortunately, because of things like, you know, Photoshop and CGI and, you know, now AI, we really need something that can help us validate, hey, this is actually, you know, a real piece of evidence.
Yeah, I've had some people tell me they believe that Bigfoot might be from another planet visiting, and I don't know why. If Sasquatch or Bigfoot or whatever you want to call it was coming from another planet, why is he hanging out in the woods?
Yeah. Well, maybe their planet is like that, you know. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, what ifs and what have you, but yeah, I think they're possible that these are, you know, beings from another planet, but
maybe Earth is just like a rest area.
Exactly.
Just stopping to pee.
right, exactly. Yeah. I think that there's got to be something behind how, with a lot of the claims or the experiences even of you know, Bigfoot and whatnot, that they have this ability to kind of disappear. And that, I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm not saying they use a cloaking, you know, technology. I'm not saying they go into another dimension. I'm not saying anything. I think there's got to be something there that they have the upper hand on us in that respect as well.
Yeah, a lot of people believe it's kind of like the old Predator movies from the 80s. Where
right.
Which would be really kind of cool.
Yeah.
If you're a Sasquatch, to be able to do that. Because you definitely want to be able to hide from us crazy humans.
Yeah, without a doubt.
So have you gone up in the woods looking to have another experience, you know, just kind of investigating, see what you can find?
Yeah. So it was, I want to say 2021, I put together an expedition and invited three close people, Mike Beers, Casey Goodwin, and Brent Leslie. And we traveled out to an area that actually years prior, Brent and I had gone out kind of scouting, and it was kind of a crazy experience when we went out scouting. And I have not this particular moment that I'm going to talk about on video, but I have another moment that was on video. But we were driving down way deep in the Gifford Pinchot, and we had our windows down. It was kind of a day like today, 60-ish, but, you know, cloudy. And all of a sudden we hear a big caliber gunshot. And we both looked at each other and, you know, we were like, what was that? You know, and it could have been somebody out there hunting or even target shooting. But then the next thing we know is we heard like lower caliber, like 22 is what I suspect. And we could hear them firing off. And then all of a sudden we hear it whizzing by the vehicle. And next thing I know, I'm throwing it in reverse, backing into trees, and then gunning it down this logging road as fast as I can get away, because I was like, what did we just come across? And, you know, the reality is it was probably like a grow operation or a remote meth, you know, lab or something, but, and they didn't want us near there. So we reported the GPS coordinates to the Skamania County Sheriff's Office, and they, you know, conducted their own research or an investigation on it. But fast forward, later that day that we were there, we were driving back still, and it was dark. And again, we had the windows down, and we were just discussing stuff. And all of a sudden, I smell this just crazy pungent. It was a pretty offending smell.
Yeah.
And one of the first thoughts that came to my mind was, you know, like mountain lion urine or something. But then as I got closer to it, you know, I realized, I was like, wow, this is different. Yeah. And it was just it was almost like you could taste it, and it was really nasty. But I got out and we looked around and couldn't see any, you know, anything that, you know, might indicate something had crossed right there. So yeah, that was probably the closest we got then. But then, you know, when we went back actually and did the expedition in 21, we actually had something come into our camp. Truth be told, I mean, I just have to own it. I was too afraid to look out my tent.
Nothing wrong with that.
I just didn't want my head to be ripped off or you know, whatever. I didn't know what was out there. But it was really quiet in many ways on how it moved around. But it also seemed like it was not small. So, and then one, you know, Mike had something pushing down on his tent, like towards him while he was laying in his cot inside.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So it was a pretty bizarre situation. But, you know, again, we didn't have anything to pull, you know, as far as, you know, any collectible evidence or, you know, hair, anything. So it was more of a good trip to kind of exercise and keep, you know, that research in my mind more fresh.
Did you guys have firearms and things to protect yourself?
We did.
Okay, that's amazing. I can't imagine going out there without.
And that just goes to say, even then, I was like, yeah, I don't know if I had. I mean, I didn't have the backbone. I'm not going to lie, people. I was actually worried about what would see me and was waiting for my head to pop out.
Yeah, you just never know. Yep. Especially, you know, it could be maybe it was more people that are up there with, you know, their drug issues and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, you don't know. But I mean, there, I will be honest with you. I do have regrets. If I had that opportunity again, I probably would make sure I stuck my head out and looked around at least. So
I think I couldn't help myself.
I thought the same, but in that moment, I was like, oh man, this is a little freaky.
Just want to be anywhere but there.
And I have this little thin, you know, tent wall that's keeping whatever is on the other side of it from me.
Yeah.
So.
Do you think that a lot of sightings are like misidentification, like it's a bear or something?
Absolutely. I think that's a primary piece. And, you know, I mean, I get it, you know. People try to, you know, do what they can to help, you know, bring this understanding or this awareness that, you know, Sasquatch are out there and they're real. But unfortunately, you do have things like bear that can walk on two. And and I did consider all of that, especially later in life, when, you know, looking back on my experience in the Olympic Peninsula on that highway. But this didn't walk like a bear does. You know, bears walk kind of goofy looking. Yeah.
Like they're drunk.
Yeah, exactly. And this was something that was very well adept at you know, doing so.
Yeah. I always think of a lot of it, you know, with bears and stuff, like, because they'll be like, oh, it couldn't have been a bear. It was like 10 feet tall.
Right.
Well, you were scared as hell. That's why it was 10 feet tall. Mm-hmm. You know, everything's bigger when you're scared.
Exactly. And it kind of like takes us back to our childhood almost, because like as a kid, I remember things and I was like, everything was always bigger as a kid. And then when you get scared, everything is always bigger when, you know, you have that experience. So.
Yeah. So what advice would you give to someone that was going out into the woods to search for a Sasquatch?
Don't go alone.
That's good advice.
Bring, you know, if you can bring, you know, some kind of firearm or any kind of, way means to protect yourself, against mostly animals, but you know, in this day and time, you just never know who you're going to run across out in the middle of nowhere. And now you're, now you're working on wrong turn number six or something, you know?
All right. I want to talk about your experience when it comes to investigating the paranormal, when it comes to ghosts and that kind of thing.
Sure.
What led you to that? And how did you get started, like, actually getting into finding places to investigate and getting, like, your first investigation, that kind of stuff?
Really, it was like, okay, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and there were things like the infamous, you know, Barnes Hospital here at the Fort Vancouver Barracks, the old, you know, hospital that runs parallel to I-5. And so I was like, I would imagine those places have some kind of history and are steeped with a lot of maybe traumatic things and therefore could be a good location. I also looked at places like the Slocum House. There were, you know, just numerous different sites around here that I had heard, you know, that could be or were known to be haunted. And so I started researching those, and that's where I kind of just started doing that. But what I did, and this is to kind of date myself a bit here, but MySpace was kind of my my way to reach out to certain people. And so I connected with people that way, and I was networking. And so I would come across people who had connections or were, you know, the person to reach out to. So that's how I kind of started off.
Okay.
And it was all local.
I want to point out what he was talking about, reaching out to people and getting permission. You know, so please, like, if you hear of us talking about a place locally and you want to go check it out, don't just go check it out. Get permission. Don't ever go someplace you're not supposed to be, because when you do that, you make all of us look like a bunch of,
Yeah, well, and not only that, I mean, I'm looking out the window here in the studio at a very famous, you know, cemetery here in Vancouver, and it's got signs for a reason. It, you know, it has a curfew, and so that's one of the things I've taught my team, and that was part of what I kind of initially got, you know, set in place before I actually went and did any kind of case studies was documentation, things like, you know, permission from the, you know, the landowner or the homeowner saying, hey, you can be here for on this date between these times and this time, you know, and, you know, the list goes on from there, different scenarios and kind of forms that you might need. And that's just CYA. Because again, like you said, we don't need any other yahoos out there making bad names for us breaking in and, or being somewhere that they're not allowed to, you know, just because they think they're entitled to.
There are many cool locations that we're not allowed to go into because somebody has done that and ruined it for everyone.
Yep.
So do you have a favorite place that you've investigated?
I would probably say my all-time favorite location was in Sublimity, Oregon. It was a 100-plus-year-old home, and I got to investigate it twice. The reason why I find this particularly most special to me, I guess, is that when I reached out to the client, I don't remember how, but it might have been with regard to a connection with Martina and Todd Baker.
Okay.
I know they had some done some investigating with this client, but they were actually looking for someone who could bring out a trusted, legit psychic, right?
Okay.
So I set out to do that for them. So I interviewed, you know, I obviously reached out with my network of people and started putting, you know, the feelers out, and I got to interview a few different individuals, and I chose this one lady. I'm going to leave her name, you know, unmentioned for now, but at any rate, she came with a great recommendation, and she seemed to be pretty, you know, sharp with her, her ability. So the rule was, you know, okay, I would like to bring you in on this investigation, but I can't share anything with you because I want you to help, you know, corroborate, you know, some of this, the claims. Yeah. So fast forward, we get the investigation locked in, and we're driving out there, and she's following us in her own vehicle. So, you know, I would call her and say, hey, are you picking up on anything while we traveled down to Sublimity? And she was like, no, not so far. And then probably 25 minutes away, she started picking up on stuff. And one of the things she picked up on was, she said, I see an elderly man in an upstairs window. And she goes, I don't even know if this place has an upstairs or not, but you know, I see an elderly man and he's looking out the window and he looks really concerned. So, anyways, we brought her in. She was dang good. I mean, she was so, so accurate. It was crazy. One of the pieces of history about this house that makes it so special for me was it was a house that was considered a safe house essentially for like Native American children, African American children, you know, any, you know, minority at that time was, you know, safe in this home. The problem was they didn't have a basement. They had an attic. So like if the neighbor guy wanted to come over and, you know, have lemonade on a hot summer day, they'd have to stuff these kids up in the attic. And there were claims that children had died from sweltering heat and exhaustion in the attic. And so on video, we have this psychic up there not knowing anything. And you get to see the client's reaction and everything. She's standing in the drop-down ladder access, you know, entryway, and they're just looking around. She's like, I don't know why, but I see children and they're like sweltering in, you know, and in the heat and stuff. And they're like looked at, she was like even describing like, are they bad kids or whatnot? So there's many more, you know, stories to this particular investigation, but that was the most fascinating. And that again, also wow, made it rock solid to me, that folks that have these psychic, you know, mediumship abilities and so on and so forth are very valuable as long as they are legitimate.
Yeah, everybody's a medium these days.
Exactly. You got a lot of ego out there.
You take one of William Becker's classes and suddenly you're a medium now. So
exactly.
I see so much of that and so does he. And he's always, you're talking about it. It's kind of funny. So talk about your investigation process. Give me an idea of what the process from starting an investigation to the conclusion is like.
Sure. I developed a number of phases a while ago that I felt like, you know, helped me kind of stay on track and kind of have a methodology to how I go about a case study. And so, you know, there's the initial phase, which is really learning of that, whether it's you know of a location, you've reached out, you know, you're making that contact, right? And then right immediately afterwards is basically the research phase. And that's really just going in and it can include you, you know, going on site and walking around, interviewing, going through microfilm or microfiche, any kind of historical records, you know, again, interviewing other witnesses if there are, and so on and so forth during that part. And that's a pretty laborious phase because, you know, it can be pretty involved and time consuming. So, and it's not the most invigorating.
Yeah, it can be rather boring.
Yeah. And so after that, then that's pretty much we go into that investigation phase where we, you know, go on that location and execute a, you know, an investigation of some sort. And that could be a low profile where we're just setting up gear and we're not really actively going around you know, asking questions and stuff were just kind of almost like monitoring. Like if you recall that scene in Poltergeist, the, you know, where they set up in the living room, kind of like that. And then we have more of your traditional modern style, investigative, technique where we are out there and we are, engaged and we're trying to, you know, do whatever, to maybe
communicate,
and get some kind of response of sort. And there are other phases, you know, obviously like the analysis phase when we get the stuff that we think might be, worthwhile to look deeper into. That's the other heavy lifter right there. It's a big, big job because, you know, people don't realize you set up four surveillance cameras, you know, on a DVR system, and that's whatever hours long times four, and then times that by how many times you're going to rewind and pause and, you know, the same with audio, same with photo. So it takes a long time. And then
you're at least looking at double that.
Oh, at least. But, you know, we end it by, and it's not ending meaning like, hey, we're done with your case. And we never close a case. We just, you know, obviously show them what we found. We let them form their own opinions because that's really up to them. Yeah. We try not to influence them and say, you know, hey, this is what we think's going on. You know, we just try to leave it there and obviously address any kind of either concerns or just, you know, inquisitive, you know, questions they may have.
Try to help them feel more comfortable in their space.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or get answers, you know, to explain why, what's going on.
What do you think about all these fancy gadgets people have come up with for investigating?
Well, that is, my friend, a big piece to where I like to focus because, again, I have, you know, a tech background. And by all means, I'm not saying I'm the end-all, be-all. I'm not the SME, the subject matter expert on this. But what I'm saying is there are a ton, and I mean that, a ton of gimmicks being sold right now. And people are spending hundreds, sometimes over $1,000 for some of this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say, when it comes to these types of, most of them seem to be ITC, you know, type devices that are trying to help us commune with the other side of the veil, these spirits and what have you. There's a different flavor from everything, especially ever since, you know, Frank Sumption invented the Frank's box. There's been a variety of different, you know, versions of that kind of inspired device being made. But the thing is, you need to explain to the field, right? Nobody's trying to take anything from you. Nobody wants to take that you invented this thing.
Right.
Nobody wants to take money out of your pocket or anything if that's, you know, what you're after. Nobody wants to take your notoriety even. What we want to know is, how the heck are you making this device? Yeah. And how the heck does it, what is your way of communicating through this device? How does this technology supposedly, like take, for example, old cassette tapes, you know, a lot of researchers believe that the mechanical end of that created this noise, a white noise, if you will, that they seem to feel helped these spirits, you know, speak back to them on magnetic medium.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we need to know that about these devices that are out there because, again, it should be all peer reviewed. It should be patented and open to the public to understand, not for robbery, not for, you know, stealing and riding the coattails of, for the betterment and understanding of the field of this research. So I tell people, okay, if you've got a spirit box or...
Which is literally the most annoying piece of equipment.
Yeah. And, or you've got like, I don't know, an ovulus or something, right? They've got these, you know, sensors in those and whatnot. Well, my question is this. Ryan Institute, for example, are they using these devices, right? They are an accredited, respected, you know, organization, research organization with people with, you know, lots of accolades and knowledge. why aren't they using those? Why aren't they, you know, something in the field that people are, that truly are trying to push this field forward? Why aren't they using them? And secondly, whatever you're capturing on that, imagine yourself sitting in the center of a circle of 20 of the best parapsychologists around the world, psychics, mediums, you know, you name it, anybody that can help us explain further, you know, as to what's particularly supernatural in origin. And how do you think that evidence that you're bringing to them in that circle, how do you think it's going to stand up to their scrutiny?
Yeah.
You know, and often the room goes quiet, you know, with these devices of people who are like, you know, I firmly believe that I'm getting responses from family members or other people I've never met and all this. And I'm like, I'm not trying to dismiss that, but we need to know how it works. Yeah. We need to understand. You can't go on blind faith. That's not how this field works. It's not blind faith. We must understand so that way we can keep pushing it forward and learn more and understand.
That's why I always tell people, you'll never hear me say this is something.
Yeah.
Because to me, I say this is what I came up with. This is what I believe. But I'm never going to tell anybody that, oh, this is a ghost. Because I cannot prove that.
Yeah.
I can say, talk all I want, but until I can prove that, then what do I have? Everything that we believe to this point in paranormal research is completely a theory. We've proven nothing more today than we did when we first started this. Why do you think that is?
Because people are trying to make money on gimmicks. They're not, their focus isn't really on aligning with psychical studies, you know, parapsychology and whatnot. They are basically regurgitating and repeating a lot of what they see on TV or movies. And while those are entertaining and, you know, cool in some ways, and sometimes, you know, you get to see some new tech or techniques being employed by these people that might be, you know, good, you know, potentials for consideration. The thing is, you know, that's entertainment nonetheless. Yeah. So we have to stop, you know, mimicking a lot of what we see in these and actually do our due diligence research and understand, one, limitations of these pieces of equipment that we're operating and swinging around.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times at conferences or at investigations over the, you know, many years that I have worked with people who didn't even know how to turn on certain functionality of their devices. I tell people all the time, knowing what the frequency response range of any device that you're using is important, because if you're squelching yourself by having a smaller window of where this device can record and you know, catalog or whatever to an endpoint, well, what if you could have something that has a wider window, you know?
Yeah.
Not only that, I think you need to take a look at, like, knowledge in general of just things. Like, I've seen people using night vision, you know, capable camcorders, and they're using just the built-in IR lamps in them. And and it's like, yeah, your quality. And that's why we see a lot of stuff. We're like, man, I mean, why is Bigfoot always, like, you know, blurry? Or why are the ghosts, you know, kind of like all distorted, or, you know, doesn't really look like what we would think, right? And this is also due to the not understanding, hey, maybe I should pair this night vision camera, even though it can see in the dark, its lux rating value is not like zero that it can see in pitch dark. We're not working most of the time with equipment that is like, say, military grade or whatever. So pairing it with the proper accessory, lighting or whatever, IR, UV, those are essential to getting clear recordings and whatnot. Not to mention anything that you can get nowadays that can data log, that is the way to go. And I want to repeat that one more time for everybody. Data logging is everything. If you're just collecting stuff and whatnot and saving it on a drive somewhere, that's all fine and dandy. But if you're really trying to find out if there's a theme or if there's a trend or, you know, some kind of explainable environmental condition that's coming into to factor, that's where data logging becomes super powerful.
I always tell people when it comes to the fancy devices, especially anything to do with your cell phone, first of all, your cell phone should be on airplane mode or off, because you got all these fancy gadgets going off and all this stuff, and you, which is your best piece of equipment on an investigation, are paying attention to that.
Yeah.
Nothing else goes on around you. You're on your phone looking at some stupid app or, or your REM pod or something going off because you're looking at your phone.
Well, and I just had this conversation with a friend last night saying that, you know, yes, I'm technical, and yes, I use a critical lens, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I consider myself a skeptic, but I am a believer, okay? And so I believe that this is a reality, that supernatural phenomenon is something that is taking place in our living world. But I think it's due to the fact that the living are involved in that equation. That being said, right? So, you have, you know, these occurrences or whatnot with these pieces of equipment. You must understand what it can do for us and how it's playing its part or what it's keeping us from either hearing or seeing, you know, all of that. But yeah, it's an important dynamic, I think.
So I want to hear about some of your fun experiences. You know, what's a, like your favorite piece of evidence you've collected or the, like an experience you had on investigation that maybe scared the crap out of you?
I mean, there's a good handful of, especially when it comes to formal investigations. But I would say, I'm not saying this is my favorite, but here's what I'm saying is it's the most profound one. And it was not to do anything with formal investigation. Matter of fact, I was living in Longview, Washington, in like 86 or 87 or something like that. And we lived in a duplex there. What we didn't know was adjacent to this duplex, something bad had happened 3 or 4 years or something like that before. And here I am in my bedroom, you know, not shortly after we moved in, started having crazy nightmares and dreams and whatnot. But the one that, you know, took the cake really was the night when, so my bed, you know, sat next to the closet door. And I religiously, like any kid, you know, made sure that that door was shut and latched. And then I would turn my back to it and, you know, go to sleep. And one night I was laying there trying to get ready to fall asleep. And I felt like a breeze. And I thought, wow, behind me is the window also on the side of the house in that bedroom. Maybe for some reason it's open and there's a breeze coming through. So I turned over to look at it. And that's when I saw that the closet door was open. And I literally saw a very dim lit light in there, kind of like dirty blonde, kind of darker blonde hair, like teenage girl. She had a baby blue dress on. The clothes behind her, like my clothes hanging up, were kind of moving around like that breeze was, you know, manipulating them. And she was kind of, I don't know how to describe it. She had both her palms upright facing me. She never moved her mouth, but yet telepathically I could hear her saying, come with me. And she'd roll her fingers like this.
Oh, wow.
And I know the, you know, listeners can't really see that, but starting with like the pinky kind of almost doing the wave, you know, with your hands while your palms are up. And she was doing this and I could hear her saying telepathically, come with me. And of course I was so scared, I couldn't even make a noise, you know, that kind of, that fear. And finally, when I rolled back over, I darted out of my bed and out of the bedroom. It's just, you know, screaming bloody murder. Yeah. And so that made my mother start really, you know, with how convinced and how, you know, convicted I was at what I saw and experience, she was like, I need to look into this. He's been having these weird dreams and all this stuff. And now this happened. So she saw a neighbor out washing his car, started chatting with him, and he's like, yeah, I've been living here for several years. And he says, actually, that apartment that or that duplex that's about, you know, 15 feet away from your duplex, a teenage girl was murdered in that duplex. And when we, you know, my mother went to the Longview library, she spent time going through microfilm and old newspaper clippings. She actually found it. And so, long story short, you know, now I am 50 and I am circling back on that particular case with my mother as a consultant. And we're going to, you know, delve into that to, you know, find out more of what we can understand if, in fact, that what that girl I saw in that closet was, you know, this this murdered
what
girl
that she had.
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the things that we want to talk about here is mental health when it comes to the paranormal investigation. How does that affect you? And what is your advice for people going into if they want to, like, do this kind of stuff? How do you keep yourself in a proper mental state to
make this work? Yeah, I think that's an extremely crucial topic that needs to be discussed more. It's near and dear to my heart because, one, I suffer, you know, from, you know, anxiety, depression, panic attacks, you know, just PTSD from, you know, life and, and general overall. But, like, I think if you're dealing with something we don't fully understand or know is even there at times, and if it's, you know, benign or malevolent, human, non-human, right? We can consider all that kind of potential. You should be in the right frame of mind. You should be able to be able to detach yourself from things that have been bogging you down, you know, stressing you out, upsetting you. So I feel like mental health is extremely important, that we should always put ourselves in check, and that starts with ourselves, and it shouldn't be a team lead that has to point you out and say, yo, bro, you're having a bad day. I don't think it's wise for you to be going on this particular investigation. That needs to really start with that individual themselves. So I count it for myself as, you know, take a look in the mirror, Ben. You know, how are you doing today? If you're not mentally, you know, right, if you're struggling internally in any fashion or, you know, whatnot, and you can't shake, you know, those things that are, you know, ailing your mindset, then I think it's the right thing to do to bow out and you know, not put yourself in a precarious situation because, again, we don't know, right?
Yeah.
And also potentially make things worse for the client.
Yeah, if you're not good to your client, if you're not good for yourself. So.
Exactly.
Well, it's been a great time talking to you. If somebody wants to get a hold of you and ask you some questions, maybe get some advice or have you help them with their paranormal issues, how can they get a hold of you?
OnlyFans. Oh, no, I'm just
I
kidding.
I figured
I'm
that was
kidding.
The case.
No.
Footfinders.com.
No, right now I'm in the process of rebuilding ASEP's website and, creating for the first time Washington Paranormals. Probably the best thing to do right now to reach me while I get things back up to speed and what have you is, you know, Facebook's a good avenue. You know how it says facebook.com/whatever person, you know, got for a name. You can look mine up as Benigmatic. It's the word enigmatic with my first letter in front. And my name's Ben Robison. But you can also reach out to the ASEP mainline, which is area code 971-200-5276. Those are best ways right now until everything's back up and you know, running like I want it to.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
Shriners Children's has opened a new pediatric orthopedic clinic in Vancouver. The clinic offers evaluation and follow-up care for children and teens with orthopedic conditions, including sports-related injuries. Care is available regardless of a family's ability to pay. Details about the Vancouver clinic are at shrinerschildrens.org/Vancouver Clinic.
The Columbian in Southwest Washington continues to offer the most comprehensive and consistent coverage of our region and our people, despite the challenges faced by local newspapers nationwide. Valued donations to our community-funded journalism project via the Local Media Foundation pays for local reporters to provide expanded and in-depth coverage of key local issues in print and online, including homelessness, transportation, and the environment. For the most thorough daily coverage, visit Columbian.com. Please consider donating or subscribing today.
Support for KXRW Vancouver comes from On Point Removal Services. On Point Removal Services is a Vancouver, Washington-based junk removal service that proudly serves all of the Clark County area and beyond. Offering residential, office, and construction junk removal, On Point will do all of the loading, pickup, hauling, and cleanup on your project. And On Point is fully licensed and insured. For more information, visit their website at onpoint-removal.com.
You better work!
Discover our city's hidden gem, hiding right below the sidewalk. Underbar is a speakeasy-themed cocktail lounge located downtown Vancouver. As an LGBTQ-friendly and gay-owned space, it is a go-to destination for weekly events such as comedy, trivia, bingo, and open mic nights. Local artists are featured every first Friday of the month, and every fourth Sunday is Underbar's Underground Drag Brunch Show, 2 to 4 p.m. More information and location can be found at underbarvancouver.com. That's underbarvancouver.com.
KXRW is supported by founding partners Morrell Inc. Print and Marketing. Since 1993, Morrell Inc. has offered high-quality, creative, and innovative solutions from their woman-owned, union-staff, state-of-the-art print shop. Morrell Inc.'s experienced staff uses the latest technology to solve clients' marketing needs. Find Morrell Inc. at morrellinc.com. That's morrellinc.com.